everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Just a few weeks ago, the world turned its attention to an unknown medieval woman from a monastery in Dahlheim, Germany, or more specifically, to her teeth. In her calcified plaque, or calculus, researchers discovered tiny particles of lapis lazuli, a mineral that was used in the Middle Ages to create a very, very expensive ultramarine-colored paint. This nameless German nun grabbed the world's imagination by showing that women, too, can be high-caliber artists in the Middle Ages. Naturally, when I read this story, I wanted to go straight to the source to find out more. Joining me on the podcast today are two of the co-authors of this study, Dr. Christina Warriner and Dr. Allison Beach. As well as being a professor, Christina Warriner is the group leader of microbiome sciences at the Max Planck Institute of the Science of Human History. Allison Beach is an associate professor of medieval history at The Ohio State University and the author of several books, including Women as Scribes, Book Production and Monastic Reform in 12th Century Bavaria from Cambridge University Press. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome these two women to the Medieval Podcast to tell us more about their fascinating discovery and what it means to medieval history. So thank you, Christina and Allison, for being on the podcast today. I'm really happy to have you talking about your new discovery.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure. So, Christina, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what the project was in the beginning? You were going to a convent in Dahlheim, Germany. Is that right?
That's right. So this project started out with a completely different focus. The site was actually excavated in 1989 as part of a building project. So Dahlheim today is a museum. With a large monastery on it that actually postdates the monastery we're going to talk about today. And the museum was expanding and constructing a new building. And during the digging of the foundations, they encountered a medieval cemetery that dates to roughly the 10th to 13th centuries. And so the cemetery was partially removed in order to make space for the building. And about 150 individuals were then taken, the skeletal remains were taken to the University of Mainz, where they were used as a teaching and research collection. And then they were there for several decades, but the university needed space, and the collection was actually scheduled to be cremated and to be reburied. And it was at that point, I was at the University of Zurich, that we learned about this really amazing skeletal collection and applied for to be a new home for it. And so that was granted, and the skeletal collection came to us, where, again, it served as a teaching and research collection for the medical school at the University of Zurich. And what we were initially very interested in learning from this was about the history of arthritis. Wow. So a completely different purpose. And I was also really interested in learning about periodontal disease. So when I first started working with this collection, and in particular with the teeth, it was really to understand the history of periodontal disease. And we stumbled across the lapis lazuli completely by accident.
Wow, what a surprise. And by the way, that's a great save that you managed to save all these skeletons from being cremated. I'm sure that everybody is grateful for that. So what happened? You were just kind of scraping at the teeth, looking at it under a microscope, and saw these flashy blue things?
Oh, a little bit. So we had divided the project up into components. And the component that I was mainly responsible for was trying to isolate DNA and proteins from the calculus, or the tartar on the surface of the teeth. And the reason why is it's really a calcified oral microbiome. It's calcified dental plaque. And so I was doing the genetic and proteomic component. And Anita Radini, who's the first author of the study, she joined us. She really specializes in paleoethnobotany, or microfossil, plant microfossils. And so she was going to try to characterize some of the dietary information, or gather as much dietary information we could from these individuals. And one way you can do that is plaque, because it's sticky during life, tends to trap lots of bits of food that you might be eating during the day. It also traps things like pollen that's blowing in the air in the spring. And so you can learn a lot about people's diet and also their kind of environmental exposures by looking at starch granules and plant particles and pollen that becomes entrapped in calculus. So that's what she was doing. So I had taken part of the calculus and had extracted DNA and proteins, and she was taking the other part of the calculus and looking for starch granules and other things. And so she had done this on a number of individuals, and she had identified what she expected. She found wheat starches, and a variety of other kind of food remains. But then she came to one of the individuals, which was B78, and she called me and said, I don't know what is happening, but this person has their calculus is full of blue particles. And I thought she must be exaggerating. There must be like some sort of vaguely blue grayish material. But she sent me photographs and I was absolutely blown away. They were bright, bright blue, unmistakable and unlike anything we had ever seen before. So we knew we'd found something really special, but we had absolutely no idea what it was. And because also our work had been so situated in terms of like health studies, we realized we were really out of our depth in terms of understanding the medieval historical context of the cemetery, and we needed to really reach out for help. And that's how we ultimately ended up meeting and working with Allison.
So Allison, you must have got a phone call and email saying, we're looking at teeth and we found some weird blue stuff in it. So what were you thinking when you got this call?
Oh, well, they sent me an email and I was walking around in Cologne. I live in Germany part of the year, and I got an email from people I'd never heard of before talking about dental calculus. And my first reaction was, ew, that's gross. Why are you contacting me? And then I realized talking about lapis lazuli in teeth. And my first thought, which I believe they had already had, was she must have been doing something with book production. Something to do with painting and pigments. So I was immediately excited, and I emailed them right away back and said, you know, this is incredibly exciting. I've tried to find the email. I can't find it. but I think I was pretty overwhelmingly excited. And by the time I got back to my my apartment in Bonn, which is about 20 minutes from Cologne, I was emailing them all kinds of things that I thought it might be and might mean. So I got excited pretty fast once I got over the idea that this incredible new window on B78's life was coming from her dental calculus.
Yeah, so as a historian, when you heard there's lapis here, you immediately thought of book production?
Well, they contacted me because I'm a specialist in women and book production in the 12th century and in German-speaking lands. So I don't want to give the impression that they had no idea what they were looking at. One of the successes of this project was that that Tina was trained, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tina, but I think you were trained, at least partially, you studied history. Is that right? Yeah. So this looked, she was very clear to think that there was some significance to this beyond just the presence of a gem in somebody's teeth. So they had already thought, Maybe it's something to do with book production. And they contacted me, and then I could provide kind of backup evidence that this was actually quite likely.
It was really critical for us talking with Allison because, I mean, we had gotten a start. I mean, it took us a while first to identify the blue pigment as lapis lazuli. That took quite a while because it was quite difficult. The particles are very small, and we actually had to bring on a whole team of physicists to help us really apply the correct methods with the correct resolution to really adequately identify these very tiny microscopic particles. They're only about 10 microns in length, which is 100 times finer than the width of a human hair. So that's the size of these particles. But once we had lapis lazuli, I did know this is a very rare mineral for this. It's coming from Afghanistan. It must be very far away. But I didn't really know how widespread it would have been at this time or how it could have gotten into this woman's mouth. I was aware of the work of Catherine Rudy that she'd done through her Dirty Books project. And so I knew that osculation was an option, but I didn't really have a sense of what the time frame was for that. And I knew that lapis lazuli as a stone had been, you know, traded as a semi-precious stone, but again, I didn't really know how it was being used or what might be constraining it. And of course, I knew that it was such an important pigment of the Middle Ages, but again, I didn't really have a good historical context for it. So this is really where Allison was able to add so much to the study.
And I understand from some of the stuff I've read about this story that people were suggesting other possibilities to both of you as being a reason why she could have this lapis in her mouth. So I read that someone even suggested she was a cleaning lady.
Yeah, I think both Allison and I have gotten that hypothesis tossed to us.
Yeah. I think the osculation idea we considered and we sort of set aside more or less, because it's a phenomenon that's much more prevalent later. There is some evidence that there were these sort of affective devotions going on even earlier than we thought before, but this is a lot of lapis. She really would have had to have been having a lot of contact with a lot of paint that she was kissing, if osculation were the reason. The bigger challenge.
Also, it didn't appear as a paint. It really appears as a dispersed pigment, which would indicate a dry powder.
Right. Yeah, it seems unlikely, but I think it made sense to include it in the article just to sort of signal that it's something that we considered. The bigger contender, and the one that has more validity, though I think it's also very unlikely, is that it was being, that B78 was ingesting it as part of a practice of lapidary medicine. From what I've heard from Anita, it would be very, this is a lot of lapis over many, many years. And the thought of that having sort of deposited in her dental calculus, you'd have to be consuming an awful lot of lapis lazuli. And this is not a skeleton that was found without a context. It's the context, the archaeological context, is a poorly documented, maybe even informal women's religious community in what we probably consider rural Germany at the time. And it's very difficult to imagine a scenario in which they had enough economic means to allow one person to consume something of that value. If you think about it in terms of the economics, in the context, the archaeological context, it's much more likely that she was using it rather than consuming it. So she would, and we have a letter in the article that we can point to document this kind of practice. It makes much more sense to think that something of this value was being sent to her to use to produce something that would have further value rather than consuming it. So I think there are lots of other science-related reasons why pigment in the teeth suggests that it's something to do with painting. But I think just on economic grounds, it doesn't make as much sense as book production does.
Right. And as I understand it, the particles are so fine, you wouldn't really need them to be that fine if you're ingesting them as well. Is that right?
True. Yeah, they could have been more coarsely ground.
Mm-hmm. So, Tina, I think the medical... And I don't know as much about the medical treatises, obviously, as the medical history community does. But I think they ingested ground lapis. That was ground stone. And that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a pigment.
Exactly. The earliest recipes I could find for medical consumption is just ground stone. It's not a refined mineral.
For people who haven't read the article, how did the pigment get into her mouth?
Well, the scenario that we think is the most likely is that she was a painter and was using it to paint. And I think there's kind of two ways that as a painter could come into our mouth. One is this refined lapis lazuli pigment is so fine that it really produces dust very easily. So when handling the powder and mixing it to make the paint, it could easily be inhaled to a small degree. I think that's very likely. And the other thing is that when you're doing fine work, you need to make the point of your brush very fine. And one way that is actually attested to in medieval artist manuals is to basically use the lips to shape the brush. So you can and this is something that's done by artists today, right? You can shape the tip of the brush with your lips to create a fine point. And if you're doing that over and over again as you're painting, you will progressively introduce the lapis lazuli pigment into your mouth. As you're doing this fine work with this pigment. So I think a combination of those two are very likely.
So this pigment would be used to make ultramarine, which is that very bright blue. And Allison, what kind of things would you be painting in ultramarine at this time?
Almost certainly liturgical books. So the sort of fine and beautiful manuscripts that would have been used for the public worship of either a monastery. Unlikely that Dalheim would have had such beautiful books. But maybe they were making them for either a bigger church nearby or a larger monastery, a men's monastery, we don't know. But almost certainly something of display value. So when you think about medieval books, you might picture the first letter of a line with beautiful decoration, something along those lines. So something very, very high quality, sort of top of the line deluxe manuscripts. not a beginner. You wouldn't give a beginner in book painting material like this. It's just too valuable.
Right. And ultramarine was used a lot for pictures of the Virgin Mary, especially, wasn't it?
I think that, and I'm no expert on pictures of the Virgin Mary, but her cloak is done in ultramarine later on. This is I believe this is an earlier period before that is so common.
Ultramarine was used for these fancy manuscripts because of its real difficulty in getting to Europe. Is that correct?
I could just say really quickly, just from a materials perspective, one thing that's quite special about it is it's extremely stable. So it's a pigment with real lasting potential. So many of the other blues are actually unstable and will fade or change in color over time, but ultramarine blue does not. And that's one of the things that on a material level made it very valuable. And then I think Allison can speak more to its cultural value.
Yeah, blue had the same kind of prestige as a color as gold because of its value. So just to give you some idea of the sort of level of the books that she would have been producing or whatever she was painting and her level of skill. This is the highest quality paint that there is.
I think what people have found very revolutionary about this is that people don't seem to imagine that women had the training or the skill or were regularly producing books like this. So what would you say to that, Allison?
Well, that topic caused quite a stir on social media after the article was released. Because a number of us, I could name a whole bunch of us, Felice Lifshitz, who's cited in the article, is one, Jeffrey Hamburger, not many, but there are a number of medieval historians and art historians who have been trying to find female scribes. I would say when I started, it was about 25 years ago. And we know, and we thought, and I think many people in the field do know that women copied books, but certainly not everybody in the field is aware of that. And it's very difficult to get people to consider when they're holding an anonymous book that it could perhaps have been either copied by women, owned by women, used by women. It's a tough a priori assumption to shift. So there's a kind of public awareness that we saw the media reaction was, oh, wow, women copied books. I didn't know that. And then within the field of medieval history, a bit of, well, yeah, although we know they copied books. But the fact is we may know they copied books within the field, but we don't have all that much evidence for it. And this is certainly an exciting new way of looking for female scribes and book producers than we've had before. So, but there aren't many named scribes. There aren't many named book painters. So anytime we have an individual that we can hold up and say this person was producing manuscripts in the 12th century or the late 11th century, that's a big thing for those of us who've spent most of our careers looking for female scribes.
I think that's very true. I think there is an acceptance in the field that women were involved in this. But again, as you say, actually proving that with physical evidence is a difficult thing to do.
Proving it is sometimes very difficult. But the day the article was released, I was having an extended conversation with a colleague by email about something that this colleague was working on. And the colleague, who remained nameless, I had to try to convince this person that this really was a book that was owned by the women at a monastery called Admont, actually where I am right now. And that's sometimes really tough to do. It's still even within the field, it's still sometimes a bit of a struggle to get women into the picture when considering the context of book production.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a bit of an uphill struggle in a lot of respects. Is it rare to find pigments in teeth? Have we seen this before, or is this just kind of revolutionary in itself to find pigment in calculus?
We hadn't found it before, but in retrospect, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. So one is, and several people have asked me this, they asked, is it just blue pigment in her teeth, or were there other pigments? Is it unusual to only find blue? And the answer is there were actually other colored particles within her calculus. The problem, however, is that for colors like black and red and yellow, the artist materials tended to use pigments that were like earth pigments, which are very widely dispersed in soils. And so it's really difficult for us to, if we find like a microscopic piece of carbon, for example, to say, was this lamp black paint? Or was this perhaps introduced environmentally through fire exposure? So it's really difficult to distinguish that. And the same with some of these red and yellow earths, these kind of ochres. It is possible that through burial and contact with soil that you could get some trace contamination on it. And so it becomes very difficult to distinguish. What made lapis lazuli so special and really alerted to us the fact this was a pigment is that it is not found in soils. It is a mineral that's found very rarely deep in the earth, and it must be mined. And so we knew right away this couldn't possibly be a contaminant, not from the soil at least. And we did extensive testing showing that it was really emerging from deep within the layers of calculus. So it was not on the surface. It was really quite deep inside. So we did a lot of work to show this. And so in that case, it was a much easier process of showing that this was lapis lazuli, it was a pigment, and it was not coming from the burial environment. Now that we know that pigments can become incorporated, this gives us a way to kind of rethink some of these other colored particles, which might also be paints, but we just hadn't been thinking about them in that way. The other thing to think about too, and this is something we discovered, and really I have to give Anita Radini credit for this because it's only because she was so conscientious that we made this discovery at all. And that is when we work with calculus, it's a calcified material. And all of the interesting things we want to see, like the pollen and the starch and all the other things, are really deeply embedded within it. It's almost like a cement. And sort of to get them out, you have to break up the calculus. And the way this has been developed in our field is to use a weak acid. And this slowly dissolves the mineral and then releases all the things that are inside that we want to study. Now, the problem with this is that when we first applied this, Anita set it up like we would normally do. But thankfully, she actually sat at the microscope and watched the process. And it was during that watching that she saw the blue pigments come out. By morning, all of the blue was gone. And the reason is that many artist pigments are unstable in the presence of acid. And so they lose their color. And so if she had done what is normally done, where you just set it up, you let it dissolve, you come back the next day and look, we would have never made this discovery. We would have never known we'd even seen it. So I wonder how many other people have actually looked at calculus that may have contained pigments, but because they prepared it in this conventional way, never even saw it. So we were really lucky that she really sat there at the microscope and watched and noticed it and then noticed the color change. And we took a whole series of images of this process because at first we didn't know what was happening. Later, when we started looking into it more and realized what the different pigments were and that so many of them were unstable, we did a series of tests and showed that actually, yes, this acid just absolutely destroys these pigments and the color fades. So what Anita then did is she went back and completely redesigned our extraction techniques using a non-chemical based method of releasing the particles, which then retains their full color. And actually, it was only at that point that we really saw the true color of the particles. We'd always seen them in this kind of semi-broken down condition. So initially, when the first images we saw, they were kind of a robin's egg blue. When we went back and actually used sonication instead of an acid treatment, they're royal blue, deep, deep blue, the color you would associate with the stone. So I think that in one sense, yes, this is a really unique finding in the sense it's the first time we've ever found evidence of artist material, artist pigments in calculus. But I really hope it's not the last. And I'm hoping that by kind of changing our technique, improving our techniques, and now applying it to a much wider range of samples of individuals from other monasteries, cemeteries, and other places, we may be able to discover more artists.
That's fascinating. That's really fascinating. Probably because I know absolutely nothing about the science, but also because whenever you look at something from this long ago, it's difficult to get the information out of it without destroying it in the process. So it's amazing that Anita was paying that much attention and has really kind of found a way to look for these pigments again. So out of these 150 skeletons, was B78 the only one in which you found this lapis lazuli?
It was, although we didn't look at all of them. So there are approximately 150 burials. What's typical of a medieval cemetery is because the burials were unmarked, sometimes you get intrusion burials into previous burials. So although there's 150 burials, there's something like 170 individuals. Some of them are scattered across multiple burials. And we're also missing parts of some of the skeletons. So I think in total, we only had about 40 individuals that had a relatively complete set of teeth and also had calculus, because not everybody did. So one of the issues we kind of run into is, especially in cemeteries that have many older individuals, they've often lost all of their teeth by the time they died. So many of the individuals in the cemetery were actually what we would say edentulous, or they had actually they lost all of their teeth already. So there were only about 40 individuals at the end that actually had both teeth and calculus to study. And for this initial pilot, because it was really kind of set up for a completely different project, we only looked at four of them in detail. So there's still more individuals we can look at, and this is going to be the subject of Anita's future research. So when she started this research, she was a PhD student. She's now graduated and is starting up her own group and just received a grant from the Wellcome Trust to really expand this research. And so this is the direction she's going to be going in to try to apply this at a much larger scale on cemeteries across Europe.
That is fantastic news, and we'll definitely be following that, I think. So, Allison, when you imagine B78 painting in her convent community, do you imagine there would be other people with the skill in that community to be using ultramarine, or do you think it would probably be one special artist?
That's a good question, and it's very difficult to say. And it's sometimes hard when you're talking about this kind of work to use the term scribe and book painter in the correct way, because we don't even know if B78 was a scribe and a book painter, or she was a specialist in painting these beautiful things. So we just don't know. You know, there are very few contemporary sources that would suggest that she was that women were specializing in either writing and or painting. The nuns scribes that I know best are at a monastery in Austria, where they worked really carefully in teams in the 12th century. They just worked really side by side, trying to have their writing look as similar to one another as they can. I mean, this is writing, it's not painting. So, but there's a certain teamwork aspect to the process at Admont. But we know more about Admont than we do about a lot of other scribal communities. So I really can't answer that question with any precision. She was highly trained in painting. That's really all we can say. Whether there was someone sitting next to her putting in the letters, you know, the regular, just writing the text, we just don't know. We're lucky we know B78 at all. I wish I could say more about the sort of overall process at the community.
Yeah, of course. I'd love to know more about the whole community, but it's fun to imagine now that we have just this small bit of information. So before I let you two go, Christina, is there anything else you can tell us about B78?
Well, I think to me, one thing that was really interesting is actually one of the reasons we picked her in the beginning is that from a kind of skeletal health perspective, she was very, very ordinary. And that's why we selected her. She had kind of an average amount of periodontal disease, a sort of average amount of age-related arthritis. She'd experienced no severe trauma or any kind of major occupational injuries. So she was, you know, from our kind of perspective that we were bringing, a very ordinary person. And it was so interesting to me to find out that We'd been misled, because she was clearly a very extraordinary person during life.
When you're speaking about her and her ordinariness, again, that spoke to me about how exciting it is, because you picture someone just having an ordinary life, and there's so much more to it than that. And that's why I love the Middle Ages, because, you know, these people are just the most amazing people, just like us.
Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about how, you know, by applying different techniques and kind of keeping our eyes open, you know, we have this opportunity to find new ways of knowing about the past. And that's something I find really exciting.
Yeah, I'm really happy that you were able to bring this knowledge to the public, the whole team, in a way that really captured people's imaginations. And I'd really like to thank you for talking to us today, because it's great to hear more about this story from the people who are working on it and really get to hear your enthusiasm about it, because it's a great story. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The full article on this incredible discovery is called Medieval Women's Early Involvement in Manuscript Production Suggested by Lapis Lazuli Identification in Dental Calculus. You can find it in this month's edition of the journal Science Advances or at advances.sciencemag.org. Or you can follow the link in our show notes. You can find out more about Dr. Allison Beach at abeach.org. That's abeach.org. And Dr. Christina Warriner at christinawarriner.com. That's Christina, WARRINER.com. Before we go, we have Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. So what's up this week, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Hey, we've got some really good pieces actually on this week, including one by you. So it's a piece on the Welsh poet Gwerthol Machain and her rather risque writings about sex. So that's a popular article for some reason on our site this week. So.
It's a fun one.
Yes, yeah, I quite enjoyed it. Adam Alley also is here with this. He looks at the Wagenburg. It's when they used wagons as these kind of defensive structures in medieval warfare. So it's a good detailed piece on that. And finally, one more I want to tell you about is Minji Su's latest article where she reports on a conference that took place north of the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
So, yeah, she is going to great lengths to write for us, I guess. So, but it's all about darkness. So, so we've got some kind of wintry stuff here and some kind of fun stuff. And, yeah, so check out the site medievalist.net this week and see what you can get.
Awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
This is episode 5 of the podcast. And so far, we've brought you everything from coconuts to calculus. So what do you think? If you love what we're doing, please take a minute to give us a rating wherever you're listening and help us bring more awesome stuff to more awesome people. As always, you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And you can follow me, Danielle Sabalski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. With the return of The Walking Dead coming up fast, it might be time to get yourself a copy of my little book, The 5-Minute Medievalist's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse, to learn some practical tips from history to help you get medieval on zombies. You can find it and The 5-Minute Medievalist on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you so much for listening and for giving us a review. Have yourself a great day.